B. Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, November 8th, 2018. Trump has provoked a constitutional crisis, and I'm pleased to see that all over the nation, people are taking it to the streets in protest as Trump appoints a hatchet man at the Department of Justice to replace departing Attorney General Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III. And I think that this is long overdue. Now, it's fair to say that the protests that are fanning out across the country today are part of a contingency plan that was put together by Common Cause, Move On, and others months ago. And their goal is not to protect the sorry ass of Jeff Sessions, although I bet the right-wing media will spin it that way. No, the effort is to try to preserve the independence, such as it is, of the special counsel, Robert Mueller. And as you probably know, I have mixed feelings about this. I do believe that Bob Mueller is a compromised individual. The way he ran the FBI, I could go on for days. But he's got this job, and while I haven't seen any evidence of the central thrust that there was Russian meddling interference that involved collusion with the Trump campaign in 2016, I do believe that Trump has clearly obstructed justice. We have the evidence for it. And I do not want to see the Mueller investigation shut down prematurely. So I will be in downtown San Rafael, California, at 5 o'clock today with my friends and neighbors. And if I get some good comments, I'll bring them to you on tomorrow's podcast. And it remains to be seen if this will have any impact, because we have this is a carefully orchestrated maneuver by Trump. And he believes that with the expanded Republican control of the Senate, with his fifth vote, Brett Kavanaugh, on the Supreme Court, and with the lame duck session as we transition from the current Congress to the new one in January, gives great opportunity for mischief without any real consequences. So it's remarkable that in the New York Times today, that Neil Katyal, who is a predictable Democrat advocate, joined up with Kellyanne Conway's husband, George T. Conway III. And the headline reads, Trump's appointment of the acting attorney general is unconstitutional. Now, these guys know the law better than I do. I think it is ill-advised, and it's politically very dangerous for Trump to take these moves. It could be what actually awakens the slumbering Republicans in the U.S. Senate. Now, they said months ago that if Trump meddled with Mueller, that they wouldn't approve his next attorney general candidate. But those promises go with the wind, kind of like Lindsey Graham, who used to be such an outraged opponent of Trump. So what Katyal and Conway write is, first, establishing that the attorney general is a principal officer who must be confirmed by the Senate. And this means, they say, that Trump's installation of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general after forcing the resignation of Jeff Sessions is unconstitutional. It's illegal. And it means that anything Whitaker does or tries to do in that position is invalid. And then both of my eyebrows arched as I read just down the page here, citations from the eminent justice on the Supreme Court, one Clarence Thomas. Now, you'll never find me citing a statement from Clarence Thomas, but the audience here is not you and me. They're trying to persuade Americans across the political spectrum, and most importantly, senators in Washington, D.C., later in their commentary, they say, we cannot tolerate such an evasion of the Constitution's very explicit, textually precise design. Senate confirmation exists for a simple good reason. Constitutionally, Whitaker is a nobody. His job as Sessions' chief of staff didn't require confirmation. For the president to install Whitaker as our chief law enforcement officer is to betray the entire structure of our charter document. And, of course, Trump plays the role of the strict constructionist, you know, who wants the original intent of the Constitution. And Katyal and Conway close by saying the Constitution is a bipartisan document written for the ages to guard against wrongdoing by officials of any party. Whitaker's installation makes a mockery of our Constitution and our founders' ideals. Then when you look at what a movement conservative this guy is, how he has been auditioning for the role of acting attorney general through commentaries that were published and interviews that he gave on television. And, of course, if you want to get Trump's attention, he watches more television than the last five presidents combined. Way too much. Even more than I do. For example, the New York Times is reporting, with unnamed sources, that senior officials in the Justice Department, including Rod Rosenstein, have viewed Whitaker with intense suspicion. He's a former college football star, was openly hostile on television and media toward the special counsel, and was seen by department officials as a partisan and a White House spy. Back in August of last year, Whitaker highlighted a story from Philly.com, that's the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper, with the headline, "Note to Trump's Lawyer, Do Not Cooperate with Mueller Lynch Mob." And he also gave interviews to Don Lemon, who is the lightest of lightweights on CNN. Just a quick aside, last night I was watching Don Lemon, and he interviewed John Dean. Now, Don Lemon is much younger than I am, and he did not experience Watergate firsthand. I understand that. But he was fumbling so badly, he didn't know what job John Dean had held in the White House. And as he introduced him, he kind of just mumbled and fumbled. And later it became clear that he hasn't even read a Wikipedia summary on Watergate and the Saturday Night Massacre. Anyway, back to Whitaker here. He told Don Lemon that he would starve the Mueller investigation if he was running the Justice Department simply by cutting back its budget to as close to zero as they can practically reach. So it's also fair to say that Whitaker and Trump share views on what they consider the need for a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton and the email server. You know, I do think there are issues there that Comey overlooked, but I cannot believe that we would have any fair investigation of Hillary Clinton or the Clinton Foundation if such inquiries were launched. So I'd love to see the outcome of that. But it would be totally political, and so I can't countenance that at this particular time. Also, Ron Wyden of Oregon, Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee and a big promoter of Russiagate. Whitaker's appointments raises blaring alarms about the acceleration of obstruction of justice and a fundamental attack on the rule of law. Congress must act right now to protect the special counsel's investigation. Now, there is a bill, I think it cleared the Senate, but it doesn't have a prayer in the still Republican-controlled House before the end of the year. So I think that there's a lot of noise, a lot of drama going on. But it appears to me, if I had to make a prediction today, that this move by Trump is a carefully strategized maneuver, and that before the end of the year, before the new Congress takes over and can investigate this guy Whitaker, he'll make all the dirty moves that he has intentioned. He will be the hatchet man. Now, will he shut down the Mueller investigation? Trump repeatedly says he's not going to do that, but we can't believe him. The other concerning part is that Whitaker is not only a movement conservative, he's from Iowa, where he played football, but he's also a member of the God Squad. And in a debate when he ran for Senate from Iowa, losing to the pig wrestler, Joni Ernst, he said in a debate that he wanted to examine the worldview of judges or potential judges. Are they people of faith? Do they have a biblical view of justice? And I have a hard time, you know, squaring these people who profess devout Christianity while they support this monster who's an abomination to any standard of faith and morality that you can cite. Now, we're also told, this is speculation coming from the Washington Post, their anonymous sources tell them that Whitaker, the acting attorney general, has no intention of recusing himself from the special counsel probe of the so-called Russian interference in the 2016 election, and they don't believe that he would approve any subpoena of President Trump as part of the Mueller inquiry. And there is a conflict of interest that he has. He'll play it down and ignore it. But back in 2014, when he was running for Senate, he also chaired the campaign in Iowa of Sam Clovis running for state treasurer. Now, Sam Clovis has appeared as a witness before the grand jury, we believe, in the Mueller investigation. Now, it's not a central conflict of interest. It's not like it's Don Trump Jr. or somebody else who you might imagine is at the center of some scandal. But it is significant. Now, after he arrived at the Justice Department, he was picked by the White House, but apparently Jeff Sessions kind of liked him and didn't mind taking him on as his chief of staff. But he has ruffled a lot of feathers over there, and it will be fascinating to see if there are resignations from career prosecutors or political appointees at the Justice Department as he gets out the hatchet, sharpens it, and then swings it. I want to recommend the Daily 202 is a kind of a column that the Washington Post runs with odds and ends. And today's is worth reading. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. For example, they report to us that Jeff Sessions begged to be allowed to stay as attorney general till the end of the week. But John Kelly, acting for the president who famously loved to fire people on TV but can't bring himself to terminate a single member of his administration. He either uses Twitter or has somebody else do the deed. But Kelly said no, that he needed Sessions' resignation without delay, and that yesterday, Wednesday, would be his last day. The one of the things that appeared to drive that, at least based on the speculation of the Post here, is the Trump allies are increasingly concerned about Don Jr.'s legal exposure, speculating that Mueller would indict him for making false statements to Congress. Most of that has to do with the infamous Trump Tower meeting. And honestly, while I have no love for Don Trump Jr., I hate to see another indictment based on false statements. If there is nexus, if there is some sort of collusion, let's get to that and not have another, you know, notch in Mueller's belt that really doesn't advance the narrative of Russiagate in any significant way. The Post also says that as acting attorney general, Whitaker could sharply curtail Mueller's authority, cut his budget, order him to stop lines of inquiry. He could stop him from asking the grand jury for additional indictments, and he could block efforts to subpoena the president. He can only serve for 210 days under this, whatever it is. It's the law that governs these issues of replacement of an appointee. And I think it's important to note that Bob Mueller is not an independent counsel. Lawrence Walsh and Ken Starr were independent counsels. And even if the attorney general changed, they still had their independent job. But that law expired, and both parties were tired of it. And so we are stuck with a situation where Mueller does not have the independence of previous prosecutors of this type. Also, it's interesting to find out that Matthew Whitaker has something in common with Donald Trump. Trump ran the scam called Trump University, which fleeced to thousands of people, claiming that they were going to learn Don's secrets and prosper. Well, Whitaker worked for a Miami-based invention marketing company that was shut down last year by the FTC, calling it a scam and claiming that $26 million had been fraudulently fleeced from some of their victims. So they also report that the Mueller grand jury has been hearing evidence in the Russia investigation, meeting six of the last eight Fridays. Roger Stone is suspected to be the major focus of the investigation at this point. And let's see what else they have here. Oh, they have speculation on who the permanent replacement for Jeff Sessions might be. It could be Whitaker. That's unlikely. He's going to have a lot of dirt under his fingernails and fingerprints in places where it won't be convenient. People mentioned include Alex Azar, the Health and Human Services Secretary, former Eli Lilly CEO, and a big bud of Brett Kavanaugh, former U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, former federal judges Janice Rogers Brown. I didn't know that Rogers Brown had retired or stepped down. She was a right-winger on the California State Supreme Court and was promoted to Washington under George W. Bush. She's kind of a monster. They also mentioned J. Michael Luttig, who I don't know. Chris Christie is on somebody's list. Chris Kobach, who lost his bid for governor of Kansas after trying to be Secretary of State and control that election. He needs a job, and the Koch brothers would love it if Trump hired him. And don't forget Lindsey Graham, who has been kissing up to Trump, and many people speculated it's because he knew Jeff Sessions was on his way out. Now, many lefties like me shuddered at the news this morning that 85-year-old RBG, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is in the hospital at George Washington Hospital in D.C. after a fall in her office last evening. Now, she felt well enough to go home, but experienced discomfort during the night. She has broken her ribs before, and in 2012, she didn't even miss any work. She also returned to work quickly after undergoing a heart procedure in 2012. She's a cancer survivor who returned to work less than 3 weeks after surgery. Her next date on the court is near the end of the month, so hopefully she will recuperate quickly. Meanwhile, the once all-liberal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco has hammered the president again on deferred action for childhood arrivals, the DACA program for the Dreamers. And this is a fascinating ruling because, as I read it, they're basically saying, you know, the president has the authority to end this program because it was started by Obama using an executive order. But we only hold here that where the executive did not make a discretionary choice to end DACA, but rather acted based on an erroneous view of what the law required, the rescission, the ending of the program, was arbitrary and capricious under settled law. So once again, it was Trump's arrogance that led him to operate in a manner and try to blame Obama that gave the court this way of saying, you fucked it up, Trump. You've got the authority to do it, but you didn't do it right. And I hope that they don't read the ruling carefully enough to figure out that if they did it the right way, they could actually achieve their ugly goal. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Find folks like Jeffrey Stewart, Joe Carson, Jim Garrison, and Johnny Jump. They all kick in $5, $10, or $20 a month, and you can do it too. So why don't you? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button. You click on it, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and it's easy to pick the level of support that's comfortable for you. If you choose the $50 annual subscription, I will be delighted to send you a copy of John Dist's new rock and roll CD called American University. It's focused on the Kennedy years and the JFK assassination. Well, I actually listened on my satellite radio yesterday at the exchange that grew more and more difficult between Trump and CNN reporter Jim Acosta. And before we dive into all this, you probably heard about the controversy. But if you watch any segment of Trump's news conference yesterday, he's the one who starts the interruptions. He'll recognize somebody to ask a question, and before they've even finished, he is starting in a defensive or deceptive way to spin up the answer, to divert the the attention from the question, and to offer an answer that usually doesn't relate to what was asked. And so reporters have become more aggressive in interrupting back and not allowing the president to just bully them and bulldoze them in these exchanges. And I felt that Jim Acosta was aggressive yesterday, but he was holding his ground, and the president was dismissing him, telling him to sit down. He didn't tell him to shut up, but that's what he wanted to say. And then this White House intern, one of many beautiful white young women who are required to wear dresses to meet Trump's salacious dress code, she was clearly prodded to intervene and get the wireless microphone back from Jim Acosta and hand it to another reporter. But Acosta wouldn't yield. And the young woman, we don't know her name, we don't know anything much about her, she's described as an intern, she repeatedly tried to grab the mic back. And he said, "Excuse me, ma'am," to her, as he refused to give up the mic. And then, I've watched this video several times, she, in trying to reach the mic, made contact with his hand. She touched him first. And then, in a move that I recall from the TSA guys who pat me down at the airport when I opt out of the Chertoff scanners, they always say, "I'm going to use the back of my hand on your butt. Is that okay?" And so Acosta used, if you just put your hand out in front of you, all right, he used the lower part and the back of his hand to brush her arm away as she tried to take the mic from him. So, in that exchange, Acosta has been described by Sarah Huckabee Sanders of inappropriately touching a member of White House staff. "We will never tolerate a reporter placing his hands on a young woman just trying to do her job as a White House intern." Now, we're not aware of these tightened sexual harassment policies at the Trump White House. But now there's a whole online battle between Trump supporters and the rest of us. And I posted the video online last night, and 9 out of 10 people agreed with me that she touched Acosta first, and this is not the kind of issue that Sarah Huckabee Sanders is trying to make it out to be. The other person, one of my conservative friends, was taking the Trump line and wishing that Acosta be booted from the White House permanently. So they did pull his press credential, which is, again, abusive and bullying and Nixonian, if you will. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders sent out a video that apparently originated at InfoWars. And the accusation is that that video was doctored to accentuate what is described as the chopping motion when Acosta moved his hand and arm to push back the arm of the intern trying to grab his microphone. So all of this becomes relatively silly, except you have the White House pushing out phony so-called video evidence. And this leaves many people aghast and confused. I've linked to BuzzFeed's, it's from Fast Forward that links to BuzzFeed. They have an article which includes a lot of videos, and some video editors constructed their own videos that compared the original C-SPAN video with the one released by the White House. And I will leave it to you to decide just how important that is. But in the big picture, Trump has elevated the status of Jim Acosta the way Richard Nixon elevated the status of Dan Rather. Dan Rather was a White House correspondent. He was fairly well known, but he was not the news anchor. Walter Cronkite had that gig. And it was the exchange, the testy exchange with Tricky Dick, that really put Dan Rather on the map. I think it upped his Q rating, which ultimately led the network to name him as the successor to Walter Cronkite. And I also believe that while Trump, you know, has this whole petulant and condescending view of CNN, and he told Acosta, "Let me be president and you run CNN." Well, Acosta doesn't run CNN. He just works there. And he made a swipe at CNN's ratings. Well, in fact, what Trump has done will likely boost the ratings of CNN. And so it goes. Now, the original question that Acosta put to the president was about those pesky migrants, the caravan invading our southern border, requiring Trump to dispatch armed troops to stand around and do nothing. Notice you haven't heard much about the operation of the border in recent days? Well, the caravan has stalled in Mexico City, where about 4,500 are lounging at a sports stadium and trying to figure out whether they can make it to the border and cross. And it appears that with some pressure from Trump, the nation of Mexico is offering inducements to the mostly Honduran migrants to, hey, why don't you stay here? We'll give you some temporary visas, and we'll provide some housing and a little food. And so it appears that it has stalled out. And the threat that Trump was so viciously promoting just a week ago has completely evaporated. At the same news conference yesterday, Trump dropped into racism as well. Not content to pick a fight with Jim Acosta, he called Yamiche Alcindor, who is an African-American woman who was recently hired earlier this year at PBS. She's their White House reporter, one of the few black women in the White House press corps. And she very politely asked him a question. She asked him whether his call for nationalism means white nationalism. Here's the quote. On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. And he interrupted her, like I said. I don't know why you'd say that. Such a racist question, Trump said. Well, she did not melt. She said that there are some people that say the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that? That's a racist question, he said again, arguing that he's polling higher than ever. Blacks love him. He loves to say that. And to say that what you said is so insulting to me, Trump said. It's a very terrible thing that you said. Now, Alcindor later tweeted, I've personally interviewed white nationalists who say they're more excited by Trump than other presidents in the past. Even if President Trump doesn't intend it, some see him as directly appealing to racists. That is way too watered down, too kind, too bland, too generous. When another reporter asked Trump about the rise of hate crimes following the massacre of 11 Jewish people at the Pittsburgh Temple, he replied, well, nobody has done more for Israel than Donald Trump. We moved the embassy to Jerusalem. That doesn't have anything to do with the coded anti-Semitism of the Republican campaign messages that targeted George Soros and Tom Steyer, two rich Jewish Americans who are funding opponents of the Republicans. Trump also tried to brush off any questions about voter suppression in Georgia, where the race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp is not yet decided. He said, I wasn't involved in Georgia. I heard it was very efficient. Well, that's a flat-out lie, and we know it. And we'll get to the situation in Georgia in just a moment, but there is one more issue about the media. Tucker Carlson, who presides over a nightly opinion show on the Fox channel, he had a bunch of visitors at his home in the northwest part of Washington, D.C. last night, described as about 20 members of Smash Racism D.C., which is also described as a local anti-fascist organization. Now, I heard Rush Limbaugh describe this as a Democrat mob. And we know that Antifa is not part of the organized left or the Democratic Party. But the right loves to just mash it all together because, well, it suits their political messaging. So about 20 of these people showed up, and apparently they were pretty rowdy. Someone, according to Tucker, started throwing himself against their front door and actually cracked the wood in the front door. And I don't condone that in any way. I think you can stand outside someone's home or their place of business and protest. But I do draw a line at crossing the sidewalk or the threshold, and I do not approve of that. And on that aspect, I will support Tucker Carlson. But they're trying to turn this into some big, angry left mob to, you know, promote the false claims that the left is a bunch of angry mobsters. So to Georgia we go, and I want to tip you that I'm scheduled to record an interview with Greg Palast, who's on the scene in Atlanta, later today, and we'll have that out for you tomorrow. But Brian Kemp, the Republican who has been Secretary of State, purging the voter rolls, suppressing participation by African Americans, well, he claimed victory, and then he resigned as Secretary of State, saying somebody else should preside over the resolution and the certification of the election that he has rigged for himself. This is brazen. It truly is. Unfortunately, Stacey Abrams is not giving up. She is not throwing in the towel. She is not going to concede. And she issued this statement: "We are in this race until we are convinced that every vote is counted." Under state law, the governor's race would automatically go to a December runoff if no candidate breaks 50%. Kemp is currently at 50.3%, and so as the uncounted votes are tallied, it certainly could drop below 50%. I don't know what the recount law is in Georgia, and I'll be asking Greg Palast about that in the interview that I will plan to release tomorrow. Now, in my birth state, the Buckeye State of Ohio, someone who remains unidentified posted a video claiming, falsely, that they had witnessed voter fraud. But what they were actually attempting to report was a purported case of election fraud. In any event, it appears to be completely false. This occurred in Franklin County, that's Columbus. And an official said, after reviewing the video in our Election Day issue trafficking software, we determined that that particular machine had a paper jam, was taken offline. The voter in question was moved to another machine and cast their vote with no issues. The timestamp on the paper tape and electronic poll book confirmed the jam, as does blah, 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 blah. And the bottom line is that Facebook has agreed to take down the post of that alleged election fraud incident, but Twitter has refused, saying that they believe in robust expression. Twitter's open and real-time nature is a powerful antidote to the spreading of all types of false information. Yeah, but dude, when you know it's false, you still leave it there? I want to credit Patrick Martin, the reporter for the World Socialist website, who appeared twice on our podcast this year to share his research on the recruits, the Democrats, put into play in the House contests this year. And he exposed the long list of former spies and military veterans who populated the largest group of Democratic challengers this year. Some of them won. Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, they're both former CIA officers. Amy McGrath, the former Marine fighter pilot, did not win in Kentucky. And so the bottom line is that there were about 38 candidates who were veterans, five of them won, and the intelligence veterans like Spanberger and Slotkin increased the number to seven. Then former Obama National Security Council officer Andy Kim won in New Jersey. And let's not forget Tom Malinowski. He wasn't a spy, but he worked at the State Department after serving as the Washington leader of Human Rights Watch. And so he does have that linkage to government service in the slightly spook category. So that's at least a preliminary take on how that turned out. And I am saddened to report again another mass shooting. I didn't lead with this story because, unfortunately, we have become numbed to gun violence in this country. And a former Marine said to have mental issues, Ian Long of Newberry Park, California, went into a country music dance hall or bar in Thousand Oaks, that's Ventura County, just north of L.A., shot at least 12 people, 22 wounded. At least one sheriff's deputy died. His gun had been purchased legally, but he had an illegal expanded magazine. And our leaders in Washington will send only thoughts and prayers. You've heard Trump ballyhooing his new sanctions on Iran. This, of course, is done at the behest of the State of Israel. They targeted 700 different people and entities in Iran with these tough sanctions. And some of them are going to hurt. The national airline is targeted. But the list of targets also include the crude oil tanker Sanchi, which sank after it caught fire off the coast of China in January. Another entry on the list is Iran's Tat or Tot Bank, which closed in 2012. Yeah, a lot of attention was put into creating that list of targets. Benjamin Netanyahu, under investigation in four different cases of corruption. Appears that things are getting closer and closer to him. Members of his inner circle, including a relative and a former head of staff, have been charged with bribery in relation to a controversial $2 billion deal to buy German submarines. This is in addition to the cases related to the free food, booze, and cigars that they took from international billionaires, the deal that Netanyahu allegedly made with a newspaper publisher for more sympathetic coverage, and his wife Sarah has been questioned but has not been charged in a fourth investigation, sending around allegations that an Israeli telecom provider offered regulatory incentives, was offered those, for positive coverage of Netanyahu. So waiting to see if the investigation leads to actual indictments. And I'll wrap up with a couple of quickies here today. Google, after the protest last week about its policies related to sexual harassment and the $90 million payout to Android Andy Rubin after he had been accused of sexual harassment, they have announced new policies. Sundar Pichai, the chief executive, says that we will make arbitration optional for individual sexual harassment and sexual assault claims. That's certainly welcome. Here in San Francisco, the tech billionaires who were tweeting arguments about a measure to tax large companies to support homeless services. That was the battle between Mark Benioff and Jack Dorsey of Twitter. Well, Benioff won, and voters approved Proposition C by a 60% margin. But now, we are expecting legal challenges. And the bottom line is that it appears that this ballot measure was properly brought by citizens, not by government officials, and therefore only requires a simple majority to pass. But under the rules that followed Prop 13, the right-wing anti-taxers are trying to block this, claiming that a supermajority was required. And finally, Amazon has blinked. I told you about the strike that was launched by Rare booksellers last week after an Amazon subsidiary announced plans to cut off stores in the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, South Korea, and Russia. And they have relented and will cancel that cancellation. Interesting to see how unified action can pay off. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Please share it far and wide, and you'll find it on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.